So let me call this meeting to order. I see that we have the trustees present and ask for a roll call.
Trustee Robert Foley. Trustee Rizal Chavez.
Here.
Trustee Robert Marshall.
Here.
Trustee Martin Krauss.
Here.
Trustee Tim Struthers.
Here.
Committee Chair John Butler.
Here. Mr. Blakemore, can you verify that we have a quorum? An appropriate notification of this meeting has been registered.
Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum and appropriate notice pursuant to the Illinois Open Meetings Act has been made for this meeting.
We have an agenda before us, which includes a university report, some university recommendations, and the like in front of you. Do I have a motion to approve that agenda?
So moved.
Second.
There's a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposition? Seeing none, the agenda is approved. We have minutes from the October 14th, 2015 meeting. Do I have a motion to approve those minutes?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
There's a second. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposition? The minutes are approved. This is the chance for me to make some comments. I don't have any, because I'll have some as we go through the meeting. Thank you, everyone, for being here. This is also an opportunity for me to ask if the UAC representative who's present has any general comments to make. I know you'll be participating later.
No general comments. I'll wait until we get
to dinner. Great. Thank you. Mr. Blakemore, do we have any requests to make public comment?
I have no requests. I want to confirm that with Mike, but we have no other requests. I have no requests.
Okay. Thank you. And so we'll move then to the university report, which is a continuation of our discussion at the last meeting. It's an information item for the most part today. This began with Trustee Strauss having some questions about what was exactly meant by commodities. Trustees, you'll know that there are obligations for the university to bring before the board expenditures at $250,000 or more. There are also situations in which the university may enter into expenditures at a lower level and exceeding $250,000 if they fit certain criteria, and that's what this is about. So I'll turn the floor over to President Baker.
Thanks. I think that we've got the commodity presentation. There it is. John is here to give the presentation, and I'm just going to turn it over to him and talk to us about those.
On behalf of Dr. Phillips, who's on leave this week and enjoying himself in a warmer climate, he's stepping in to address this topic, and I'll apologize up front that I'm catching up on this topic kind of short notice, and after a few days getting my head wrapped around what this topic is, I hope I can meet your intentions, at least laying out what the current situation is between the regs and how we've been operating, so it will facilitate an understanding of this issue and where we go in the future with your deliberations on this. If I can go to slide two and devote your attention to slide two, this is the heart of the regulations that I think is at issue. It's a four parts to this set of regulations that lays out exceptions to when items need to be brought to the board's review and approval process. And I want to systematically walk through each of these to explain how we're reading the regulations and how they're laying out in our practice. Before I go on to the next slide, I want to point out what I highlighted on number four at the end of the regulations, because that's at the heart of the matter. After you exhaust yourself of item one, two, and three, the exceptions provided by those subparagraphs, item four is that catch-all that says if an item isn't addressed in subparagraphs one, two, and three, then item four says if it's over $250,000, it needs to come to the board for approval and review, of course, and that is the catch-all category for this set of regulations. And I think that one's clearly understood. So it really comes down to understanding numbers 1, 2, and 3, and I'll systematically walk through those. So on slide number 3, The subparagraph one, this is the one that probably is the most interesting, probably the most complicated one. It clearly lists out a number of exceptions to the procurement, or I should say board approval process, where it says the university is authorized to enter in purchase agreements for the following categories. And it lists out utility services and library items, textbooks and food products. And then it has this catch phrase where it talks about approved generic commodities that are bid through the Illinois Public Higher Education Cooperative, the statewide contracts that are out there. And then there's a number of categories. I'll lift it off to the right side of the slide there, these commodity categories, and there's a variety of them in there. And I think the question that brought came up at the last committee meeting was surrounding the question of an IT purchase. And, of course, there is a commodity category for computers and related computer equipment. So in accordance with reading the governance regulations, I think an IT purchase that goes beyond $250,000, according to this, does not need to come to the board's attention. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but following the regulations, I think we have been following things according to the board regulations here. There are arguments, I would say, that do make sense to maybe have an exemption for bringing to the board everything that's over $250,000, because some things are pretty matter of fact. They're necessary actions that we need to do day to day and month to month to facilitate the operations of the university. And a couple of examples I use is utility purchases and food purchases. They're pretty a matter of fact and routine, and those are things that I don't know need to be complicated with additional bureaucracy coming to the board. But that's something for the board to deliberate. If I can take you on to the next subparagraph number two, if there's no questions, I'll keep pressing forward. Subparagraph two, this relates to projects. So anytime we're arriving at a contract action to award a project that was previously approved by the board in a process that's laid out in subsection 6, that basically says we don't have to come back to the board as long as that project stays within the estimates that we previously told the board about and got approval for that particular project. This relates to facility improvements, capital improvements around the university. I think that's a well laid out detailed process, and I think that's clearly understood. On the next slide, subparagraph 3, it talks about the exception for performance contracts. So a prime example is when we're doing an entertainment type contract for the Congress Center and bringing in some entertainment. That initial contract, knowing that it's going to get that money is going to come back in ticket sales, has been an exception laid out in these regulations. When we look back at FY15, just to get a feel for what the magnitude of some of the contract actions in this category, I didn't find anything that exceeded $250,000 anyway. So it seems to be a very rare occurrence that anything would go beyond $250,000 for a performance type contract. So on the last slide, I guess I just want to leave a little summary to see where we go from here and how we can facilitate the board's continuing deliberations on this topic. I sense that the first paragraph, the subparagraph there that has the IPEC contracts is maybe the area of interest, the area that maybe we can facilitate a understanding where you would like to go without maybe creating too much bureaucracy for some of the routine items that we always contract for, again, the utilities and food purchases that we make on a pretty routine basis. Very commonly go over $250,000, but there are things that we always need and will always need, as opposed to some other things that may be potentially discretionary. And so with that, I'd like to recommend that maybe I understand more and facilitate more discussions going into the future, and we have an opportunity to come back and maybe make some proposed revisions as that might meet your intentions of what you might be interested in.
Okay, so just so the committee knows, this is John Heckman. You're the new associate vice president for facilities.
That's correct. I should introduce myself.
My apologies. I should have done that, John.
You may have. I just I'm not sure that all the trustees have met you, but I've been introduced to you. So again, welcome to NIU. And so I know that Mark Strauss has a question. Trustee Strauss.
Thank you. So I am interested in B2A1, and I don't want to create an administrative nightmare that we're not prepared to participate in on a timely basis. So I'm wondering if you could give me some sense as to how many contracts you might let for what are considered IPEC commodities for some of the categories that are set out in the column to the right. That'll give me a context to appreciate. I'm not focused on utilities. I'm not focused on food purchases. Obviously, the one that did catch my eye was the substantial amount of money that we spent at the end of a fiscal year for computers, which it wouldn't have occurred to me were commodities that fell within this. And that's not to say that I'm questioning the interpretation of the regulation. We had a conversation about it at the time, and so I'm not calling into question the propriety of the purchase that was made, but it highlighted an issue for me. And some of these are probably more sensitive because you could have purchases that are significant in dollar terms, and I don't believe that any of us understood the common meaning of commodity to include all of the things that are in the list. So any additional light that you could shed on what the dollar disbursement is and how frequently these purchases are made, I think would be useful.
Yes, sir. I'll give you a little bit of what we have been able to analyze in the short time that I've been working this issue. We went back to FY15 and looked at, you know, that if that's an average year, to get a feel for, you know, how many actions are over $250,000. That may be of contention here. I think that's what you're asking about. And as we look back in FY15, there seem to be around 20 to 25 actions. It's a matter of how you interpret the action and does it fit this Category 1 sort of things, and we did it very quickly. But in that magnitude, that number of actions, maybe 20 to 25 actions, and somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 25 million worth of value in those 20 actions. Now, roughly, as I went through them very quickly, about half of those were related to utilities and food services and textbooks and things like that. So I would have to go back and discern a little bit more which ones directly apply just to the IPEC contracts and the other commodity areas that you may be interested in. But to help to give you a little magnitude, that's what we saw in FY15.
So that's a start. I would be interested in being able to get down to the next level, and then I'd also be interested in knowing of those purchases how many of them were time sensitive. So we have 4 meetings a year. If we decided we were going to just add those remaining items to our agenda at one of our regular meetings, is it likely that we would catch those, or do we have a significant number of these that are going to require action? Because at least personally, I have no interest in handcuffing anybody from making essential purchases for the institution, but I want to make sure that we have the appropriate level of control over large ticket items. That's the reason why the $250,000 limit is in there.
Yeah, I fully understand that, sir.
So if I understand you don't have that information today, but if at the next meeting we could understand that, it would help me sort of come to a conclusion as to what I think is reasonable. I don't know what my colleagues have questions about, but thank you for your input today.
And Mark, maybe John could follow up with you before the next meeting.
Sure.
Any other questions from the trustees for Mr. Heckman? Thank you very much. I appreciate your research and preparation for today's meeting. The next set of items are titled University Recommendations. They begin with a continuation of our discussion about disclosure of interest policy. You have in this packet a draft policy. I will tell you up front that I have gone over this policy with the Office of the General Counsel and made some amendments to it as a result of those discussions. So what we have in front of you today is a policy that I would like us to discuss the possible recommendations of the full board for either first reading or passage, depending on where it's placed. Mr. Blakemore will tell us more about that in his presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to actually call on the Deputy General Counsel, Greg Brady, to run through the substance. You have in your packet a proposal. This was vetted with the chair, but was also vetted with the president and cabinet. We have had some very constructive suggestions on revisions. They are primarily style over substance, although there are some areas in terms of the original draft substantively that changed a bit, particularly after the conversations with the chair. I think those substantive changes really relate to one particular area, and that's assuring greater due process, if I could put it that way, since we're in litigation on those issues often. So I think the comments that we received from the cabinet, from others who have looked at this, has really enhanced the original document that the Office of General Counsel was instructed by this committee to put together. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Greg, and he and Tom will walk through sort of the primary issues.
Right. So in the packet, as Jerry just mentioned, is a proper board item, and then attached to that is the version of the policy with the slight edits that came from the cabinet after you had received the packet through the board liaison. So we want to highlight, so that's why the highlight, I want to explain what that is. These are just minor changes that were proposed by as we had discussed in previous meetings, the board's current governing structure when it comes to conflict of interest has at least two statements of conflicts of interest. One in the board bylaws, and then we have a completely separate conflict of interest policy. So you'll see from the proper board draft board item that it's the recommendation from the university would be threefold. First, if the governance committee can choose to forward the proposed bylaw changes for more of a first reading consideration. The second is then forwarding the idea that the conflict of interest policy, which is separate, would be abolished, I guess is the word. And third, a delegation of authority to the president for the creation of a disclosure of interest / conflict of interest policy that would apply to those employees at the university that aren't covered by the bylaw. So I just wanted to clarify that. Now, Tom O'Grady is assistant general counsel in our office. Tom has been with our office for a little bit of time now and started on contracts, but I've been fortunate enough to pull him off of contracts to help work with governance, FOIA, and student affairs issues, and so he's been a tremendous help. And Tom was really instrumental in drafting the disclosure of interest policy that is before you. So I'm going to allow him to explain what we're trying to accomplish.
Thank you, Greg. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we have a PowerPoint on this.
Yes. All right.
Go to the next slide on that. The Office of General Counsel has drafted a proposed bylaw regarding disclosure of interest, and we did this to reflect the direction that we received from this committee at its October 2015 meeting. While drafting, we kept in mind some of the guidelines that were set out, and this is on this next slide here, and some of the main issues that we wanted to accomplish were to consolidate the current conflict of interest related statements into the board bylaws and eliminate references and regulations. We wanted to expand this policy to include an appearance of impropriety standard, which we've done, and we wanted to define financial interest more broadly than just the direct indirect standard that we currently have. The current conflict of interest policy provides for reporting only to the ethics officer. And in the policy I have before you, we've expanded that to include the chair, the vice chair, the president, and general counsel or the board liaison. And then as we were going through the development, we did keep in mind the statement from AGB on developing conflicts of interest. The next slide just goes over and it'll show a few of the changes that you'll notice in the bylaw. And I just went and I took what the current bylaw is, and then I highlighted what the proposal captures. The first one sets the standard about you must avoid conflicts of interest between personal affairs and their duties and responsibilities to the university. We really broaden this a lot with the proposed bylaw to include that the duty must be discharged in good faith with the degree of care that an ordinary prudent person in a like position would exercise under similar circumstances. And then we added that avoid the appearance of impropriety. The current bylaw, the next one, the current bylaw doesn't state the standard to be used in determining conflict. In this proposed bylaw, we go more in depth into what material, personal, and professional interests and expand that. It's important, the material aspect of it goes to show the importance of what the matter at hand is. And the next goes to the disclosure to the board and what you must do. And then on the other side, and we already talked about this, we've broadened what you're able to do. The effective trustee or the effective person who has a conflict has a couple of options. And the one is to voluntarily recuse himself. And if he doesn't feel like he wants to do that, then there's a determination that can be made by the executive board. At this point, I'm prepared, Mr. Blakemore is here, and Mr. Brady as well, to answer any questions you might have regarding the policy that we came up with.
So, Chair, the only thing that I will add is the policy also creates a process by which the board can ultimately determine what this board believes to be a conflict of interest that requires either disclosure by the member or by recusal. In an earlier meeting, a board member volunteered to recuse themselves, abstain from voting. That was done voluntarily. If there was ever a dispute as to whether a board member should or shouldn't, the executive committee or the committee designated by this board would make that determination, and it would be a final decision. So we put into place a process for actually making what admittedly has some subjectivity associated with it, but what really does constitute a conflict of interest.
Trustee Struthers.
Question. So the idea of reporting to the chair, vice chair, president, general counsel, or ethics officer, I kind of appreciate the flexibility, but I also get maybe a little, does that create some confusion that you need five people to really know what they're doing? I think I'd feel more comfortable in saying, give me the paint by numbers process so we don't mess it up, right? Here it is, and then the person who receives it knows mm-hmm. what to do with it exactly. So I don't know if there's what the driving force behind giving us lots of options as to who to submit the potential conflicts to.
The purpose behind several entities to report to was to provide, to be candid, flexibility depending on the circumstances. And let me give you a couple examples. One, I believe, and this is not, I'm not looking for more work, we got enough of it, but reporting to the general counsel gives you privilege, makes those communications privileged and confidential to the extent that they can be by law. And having someone to go to have that kind of discussion, other than the ethics officer, who happens in this place to be a lawyer, but if he's operating as the ethics officer, your communications with him are not privileged. And so adding the general counsel was done for that very, very yep. purpose, so that you could have a confidential conversation that our professional rules require that we maintain those when you are seeking legal advice, which is often the case, they can be privileged. Given the nature of the board's relationship with the president, It is critical that board members feel free to have discussions regarding any actions that they may have with the president. And so not having the president there, in my opinion, when we were expanding it, would have been an oversight. Not all of these issues are legal. So there are times when, as the president ultimately is responsible for putting together whatever materials that go to the board are, you know, oftentimes they're not going to be legal. It just may be, you know, I want you to be clear there. Okay. We kept the ethics officer there because that's a legal requirement under the State Officials and Employees Act. I mean, he's got that responsibility of making determinations as to what is ethics. And I obviously have what's, you know, on the legal. So that's why they were there. Since this is an actual board decision, having the chair or the vice chair and having the executive committee ultimately do that, it seemed more than appropriate to have members of the board being very clear that they could have that discussion amongst the board without ever having that discussion amongst staff, whoever that staff might be. And so having the board chair, having the board vice chair in the event it is the chair, and they want to basically run, you know, run their thoughts about this. That's why it was expanded to that.
Yes.
Can I follow up on that?
Sure.
Just part of what I think you're asking, Tim, is about the oddness of the construction of that sentence.
A little bit.
So
yeah.
If it was revised so that it said any one of
yes.
the following or, it's the and or that raises the challenge about whether you have to let everybody know some subset or just one person.
Yeah.
So maybe
and we can certainly
clarify
do.
That if the intention
that.
Is that it's any one of the above.
It's any one. It gives you that option to do it. And we can certainly do that.
I want to add, too, that there would be some scenarios under this policy in which we wouldn't expect someone to go to the board vice chair or chair. So if a member of the cabinet, for example, had a conflict, they mm-hmm. would report that conflict to the president.
Correct.
Correct.
Because this policy covers more than just the board.
Right, it does. The affected parties, in fact, that's a very good point. The affected persons is defined as, it's really the board of trustees, members of the board, but it also involves the president, the president's cabinet, and then all of the attorneys in the general counsel's office. Just given the nature of who we are and what we do, we need to have the same standard that the board has. But it does not cover employees, which is why we also are recommending that you delegate that process, given shared governance, to the president to do. This is within your purview with a limited number of employees, obviously. But ultimately, you would want a comprehensive conflict of interest policy at the university level as well.
Trust each other.
So if we decide to go that route, my biggest thing is if we're abolishing something and there's nothing in place, I mean, I don't know how this would go about mm-hmm. happening.
It would happen simultaneously.
Okay. Would have to, in my eyes.
Right. So the bylaw change requires that the board receive it for first reading.
Right.
Now, that proposal will include the three recommendations. So when we pass that recommendation on the first reading, then we go to the second reading of that. We might waive the requirement that we have a second reading and go right to it, or we might wait if the board members want 3 months or however long to review it, we might go to a second reading. But once we vote on it, simultaneously, all of those things happen.
I just don't want there to be gaps of time where we don't have an ethics code for conflict of interest clause for regular employees.
Well, for regular employees, that's an interesting question. So regular employees, let me rephrase that question in a way that I'm also interested in the answer, which is, what is the current status for regular employees? What sort of policy infrastructure regulates their activities?
The regulation of employees with respect to conflict of interest, and I want to broaden it. Ethics issues, legal issues are going to be covered by statutes that are in place, and nothing that this board can do is going to change that. So, for example, you look at procurement and requirements that people now have. You've got the procurement code itself that has very clear indications there, but you also have the State Officials and Employees Act. The State Officials and Employees Ethics Act, which still would govern. So you have already in place at the state level and at the federal level. You also have regulations that are unique. The provost is obviously here and can speak better to this than I, but when you have a series in the research area and in the area of conflict of commitment policies already in place. What the board adopting this and eliminating that regulation doesn't change any of that. And in fact, it's because you have all of those issues out there that affect employees that you want to do a comprehensive review of what's in place, what needs to be updated, changed, or whatever, and then make it part, I believe, of a broader policy. And that's what this would do. How much time it would take, how it would go, I'll defer to the provost on any other particulars on the academic side. But
I'll just say the conflict of interest policy that covers the Division of Academic Affairs on the faculty was updated relatively recently so that it's appropriate and meets all of the federal guidelines that were imposed by recent changes in federal research conflict of interest. So we certainly could, and it covers conflict of commitment, it covers mentoring issues, and so certainly we could revisit that policy at any time, but we would have to do it in a way that made sure that we didn't destroy the alignment between that policy and what's federally mandated for people.
Other question?
So is there a recommended course of action at this point?
We have not made a motion, but I would call for a motion that we recommend this policy for first reading to our colleagues on the full Board of Trustees, including the change that you've recommended to insert any one of after advise and prior to the chair under number one.
And for clarification, does that include the other steps that were discussed previously?
Yes. So the motion would be as outlined in the cover sheet. So I could restate it again and say I'm seeking a motion that we present a recommendation to approve the proposed disclosure of interest policy with the insertion that's been recommended by Trustee Strauss of any one of after advise and before the chair under number one. Secondly, that we approve the elimination of the board's separate conflict of interest policy. And third, that we delegate authority to the president for the creation and implementation of an appropriate disclosure of interest policy for persons not covered by the proposed bylaw amendment, and that we forward the item to the full board for first reading at its next meeting.
All right, I will second that motion.
There's a motion and a second. Is there any discussion?
One question, clarification. Is there a time set on this, such as annually to disclose? I don't think I read that. It seems like it must always be
by situation.
It is by situation or circumstances, and the reason for that is this board is presented, particularly on the transaction or procurement side, at virtually every meeting.
Yeah.
And so what you want to do is implement the policy in a timely way and waiting at the end or even the beginning. Now, part of the work becomes, particularly with finance and administration and the general counsel's office, us identifying where we think there may be a potential conflict, bringing it to that particular trustee's attention before the board meeting so that we can, in effect, really then begin, or the trustee maybe right. annually saying to the president, the general counsel's office, finance, whoever, here are the areas in which my business, my practice, my whatever are in. And then that'll help us. So that annual, we don't have that written here, but you're right. It would be good to sort of know, are there any changes, material changes in one's professional status? But I would want to know that whether it occurred 6 months into the year or 2 days into one's tenure. So
yeah, not to change the motion at all, but procedurally it seems that would be good to be prodded at least once a year to do that, even though it's not required in the policy. It strikes me that it would be a good practice to keep that fresh.
I don't want to put Greg on or Tom on the spot.
Now you have that consideration.
I do it pretty often. I withdraw my thoughts. I don't see a problem with adding a line in effect that says the general counsel's office or other appropriate university officials will annually make an effort to get updated information from members of the board regarding their professional and personal status that may impact, you know, their role. I don't have a problem with that at all. I don't know if we typically would put that in, but...
Well, we could. Procedurally, we have a motion on the floor, so somebody would need to make a motion to amend
that or accept that as a friendly
amendment. Take a vote on it, approve the amendment, and then you go back to the other one.
I understand your thought. I guess here's what I would argue. You're making an annual statement of economic interest. We have frequent enough contact with the people who are going to be involved in this so that I don't know that we really need to make another change.
It's a good conversation to have.
Yeah.
I think we're mindful that, hey, it's not a miss if we're not reminded to do it. It should always be top of mind anyhow, and maybe for your own benefit, whatever it may be, you submit it. You can't overdo it. Right. Okay.
And we will take the responsibility of doing a tickler for this. I'm looking at Jim Benkis as I speak. And also alert Vice President for Administration and Finance of the same. Because I think those are the two areas where this is most relevant to do.
Thank you. So I have no interest in amending anything.
We might want to consider in the future some framework by which we require some review that takes place when a member of the cabinet comes onto the cabinet or a new member of the board comes onto the board, and an annual review of the student trustee when he or she comes onto the board.
That's something I did just because during my orientation, kind of disclosed what I thought would be.
I think that's sort of the standard practice, but we haven't codified it, which we don't need to do in here, I don't think. But as we think about what are some practices we might employ, I would think that would make some sense.
We will continue that practice, but what we will do is memorialize it so that we typically do that. The other thing is each of you know you sort of had a one-on-one with either myself or Greg, where we really do ask about the more delicate kind of issues. So we'll continue to do that.
All right, so we have a motion. We have a second. We've had some discussion. Is there any more discussion? All right, all those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposition? Seeing none, this is recommended to the full board. I want to alert the trustees to a potential time issue. We lose Trustee Marshall at 4:30. So let's keep that in mind. We do have a few things we want to discuss before we end the meeting. Next, we have a proposed administrative leave policy, which, as Mr. Blakemore has said, has had some changes since I saw it last. I'll turn the floor over to Mr. Blakemore to introduce this to the...
And I'm going to turn it over to the primary author, which is Greg, to sort of walk through this.
Sure. So you can see in your packet, prepared an item, and based upon discussions with the chair, there is an option for the governance committee and for the full board on this as far as making this item a board policy or a university policy. It doesn't have to necessarily be with the board, and the current
Board of Trustees regulations. This is one of the changes I want to talk about here, where from the cabinet, one of the members of the cabinet provided some feedback. Those are the yellow highlighted portions that are different from the version you previously received. They're not too substantive, except for the person asked a very legitimate question of when we say the draft administrative leave describes an employee's work status is not otherwise covered by another type of leave recognized by the university. The question was, what are those leaves? So we put in examples where the board regulations right now have provisions for sick leave, military leave, jury duty. These are leaves where the individual requests and receives leave for a specific reason that's recognized either by university policy or law. Okay? Administrative leave is different. It's a putting a person on a work status. And so we put that in. So your board regulations currently indicate types of approved leaves of absence, but you don't necessarily have to adopt this as a board policy when it comes to an administrative leave. So you'll see in the draft board item, the university requesting that our governor's committee either approve the draft and board as a full item for board policy consideration by the board, or forwarding it to the board for consideration as a delegation of authority into the institution for adoption as university policy that would carry out probably through human resource services.
And let me, if I may, sort of weigh in. Although we've provided you an option, I think it's appropriate that I at least give you the opinion of the GC on this. I don't think we should treat this leave differently than we treat other leaves. You don't have this type of leave at the board level, but I think given the significance of this leave, obviously delegating it within these parameters is the best way to do this. If you have administrative leave, in a sense, sticking out in the board regulation, why is it treated different than these other leaves? When part of the requirement here is for the board to be reports to the board in terms of the use of this leave. Again, it's totally the board's decision, but I just think, you know, as we sort of went back and forth on this issue, you know, we should have leave policies. They should be transparent. They should be easy to access. Having to go to board for A, but going for B, C, D, and E someplace else, I think, it's at least one factor that the board considered.
Trustee Strauss.
So I understand why Mr. Blakemore would come to that recommendation. I'd like to hear in detail about the nature of the reporting requirement to the board in the event that administrative leave is chosen.
Under the current draft?
Yes.
Okay. The current draft has a has provisions. They are
the reason I'm asking is I think I sort of assumed I had the right draft, but it looks like there have been a couple other drafts after the one that I spent some time reading.
I remember, I just can't find it right now, but I don't remember what the provision is. The provision is, it is once administrative leave reaches a 3-month point, it's to be brought to the attention of the president for approval of whether it's going to be extended or not.
I think it's at the bottom of the
introduction. The introduction, right, right. So the introductory paragraph, the any administrative leave, whether with or without pay, that exceeds 3 months in duration, must be expressly approved by the president. The president will also make a report to the board of trustees as soon as practicable of the decision and the rationale for the decision. Personal determinations related to the president, including administrative leave, are within the exclusive purview of the board of trustees and not subject to procedures subject.
Right, so that language is the same as the draft that I read. So my question is, does that mean the president reports after you got to 3 months, or the president reports anytime there's somebody placed on administrative leave?
No, we had that conversation. In fact, that was one of the conversation with the chair that this draft is only intended to hit those that would go extraordinary to 3-month point, because there are the use of administrative leave is
it's up to you to decide whether you want to learn about every single situation that administrative.
The reason for my question isn't because I want to know about every administrative leave. I think we could have a discussion about whether it's 3 months or 2 months or 4 months or whatever. But I do think that the section regarding notice is ambiguous as to the situations to which it applies. So if the intention of the draft is to say that the president only is responsible to report to the Board of Trustees with respect to those leaves that meet the criteria in the prior sentence, that I think needs to be added to this last sentence to make it clear.
And that was the intent. We wanted to treat this leave as much as possible, although there are some unique provisions related to it, like we treat other leave, and the president and nobody else sort of reports every time someone makes a family leave request or the like. So it was not the intent to have it come to the board prior to or at the time that the administrative leave is granted. Mm-hmm. It was, here is a check and balance that's put in place so that people below the president understand they have to advise the president if it goes 3 months or more, or beyond 3 months.
All right. So just for the sake of conversation, if we clarified that, then the issue for me is whether there are certain uses of administrative leave that would be different from the board's perspective than other uses of administrative leave in determining what the appropriate time period is for reporting. So I don't want to interfere with the president's discretion to run the institution. If we have, it's hard to categorize somebody as a lower level employee. I don't mean to degrade their contribution to the university, but there are certainly many circumstances where decisions about leave of any sort don't rise to the level where the board would be interested. On the other hand, if the president was in a position where he had decided to place, as an example, not intended to reflect reality, the provost on administrative leave, then perhaps waiting 3 months to advise the board would not be the appropriate process or the expectation of the board. And so I don't know whether those are subtleties that we need to address within this policy or whether what we should do is respect that the president would likely tell somebody if that's what the president was going to decide to do. And I don't know what the feelings of my colleagues on that particular issue would be, but I think we would be remiss if we didn't discuss those differences and see whether it caused a problem for anybody.
I feel like notification of the administrative would suffice. Like, I don't need to know the ins and outs of why necessarily, if it's a sensitive matter. I don't know. That would just be on a degree of.
Well, this policy would ask for why.
Well,
and we'd also, the idea of the fact that we're only being notified, so theoretically, again, you could do a 3 month and a 3 month and a 3 month, and according, we could just be notified, and that would be it. But there'd be other courses. So I think your points, your remark is the nuances of do you need to do some other pieces in there based on levels or such, but is that covered somewhere else? I mean, just in normal protocol of the job description?
Well, I think common sense tells you that the board would expect that.
The board specifically did adopt provisions calling on the president to inform the trustees of any matter that any personnel matter, and I think it said personnel matter is one of the areas that may cause reputational concerns or significant financial obligations to the university, and that's as practical, I think, standard as well.
That's right. So that's already there.
That's already there. This is I would think this might be a question of the format of the report. And maybe Trustee Chavez is right here that the the rationale for the decision may not be necessary in this reporting format, but I think what this could call for is just some kind of a report that indicates this leave is taking place. And then that might even enhance then the capacity of the board to enter into dialogue with the president as to whether there is a substantial reputational or financial issue related to the leave. And I'm not sure that this is calling for every 3 months there's a report. I think this is calling for, as soon as the president is aware that someone is going to be on leave for more than 3 months or has been on leave for 3 months, there's a report as soon as practical of that leave. Now, that might take the form of, depending on the president's style of reporting, that could be an updated spreadsheet. That could be an email with one person's name on it. It depends on how we establish that protocol. I don't think we've experienced difficulty with new reporting requirements, as this committee has promulgated new policy and it's been passed by the board. We've had some reports under those new guidelines from the president, leaving some flexibility for how that takes place, I think, has worked well.
I think your
suggestion about whether we want to ask for why is a reasonable suggestion. If the reporting is to come in writing, asking for why is probably not a good idea. But I think the spirit of the document is to seek some sort of moment where there's an interaction where we can have a wider conversation if we need to.
Yeah.
And in reality, if Provost Freeman was to be put on leave, I would have called chair and the vice chair to start and then likely talk to all the board members because it would be such a significant issue.
So we have in front of us still a policy. Do we want to remove any of the existing language in the policy? Are we still at a more conceptual stage of asking whether or not we want to adopt a board policy versus forward this as part of a recommendation that a university level policy be developed? Where's the feeling of the
only question I have on that is if we forward it so that it's incorporated with the other university policies and then we decide we want to change it, do we retain the right to change it, or do we need to engage in a shared governance process to change it at that point?
Shared governance is traditionally academic policies. University-wide policies don't necessitate shared governance, but yes, shared governance is a core institution. So the board always retains the ultimate oversight. So if there are issues, the board certainly can raise those and the administration on getting those thoughts in.
The other thing that we can do is that if this committee recommends it to the full board, our action item would include explicit language. The board reserves the right to, if you wish that to be part of it. So,
yeah, if we could do that, and we can modify that the last sentence in the introductory paragraph, as I had previously discussed, then I'm fine with this.
Well, you mean the second to the last?
Well, I'm looking at the
give
right.
Give me one second. Draft. Sorry,
it's 3 months.
You're correct. It is.
This is the last sentence, right?
I think it's the second to the last.
Second to last, if I'm looking at the right draft now, reads, any administrative leave that exceeds 3 months in duration must be expressly approved by the president. And what I wanted to clarify was,
I don't think you're looking at the right.
Well, yeah, it's right here.
Yeah. Well, this is the beginning of the last sentence.
He was reading the one before it, I think. Oh, it's two before it.
You started with any administrative.
Oh, I see. There are two sentences of the yes. You're right. It's the next to last sentence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how would you like to edit that?
If it reads, with respect to any administrative leave that exceeds 3 months in duration, comma, the president will also make a report to the Board of Trustees as soon as practicable thereafter of the decision and the rationale for the decision.
Okay. Can you say that one more time? We got three lawyers here that are writing real quick.
Okay.
You want some help?
I'm thinking faster than you're writing. That's probably a good thing.
It's
all right. With respect to any administrative leave in excess of 3 months in duration, comma, then go back to the printed text. The president will also make a report to the Board of Trustees as soon as practicable. Insert the word thereafter, comma.
What we're going to do, since there's another item, is we're going to bring back both documents with the highlighted area only of the revisions that were made, so that the committee will actually see what we think you've instructed us to do. So we will do that, and then
can we advance it out of the committee to the full board with those changes? I don't know that it's worth our time to get it back here again. We have such a long agenda.
Okay. So let me understand correctly. The recommendation, it seems there's consensus has generated toward the second option. Is that correct, Trustee Strauss?
Correct. With these two changes.
So what we're essentially doing is we're forwarding a proposed administrative leave policy in writing to the university.
We're forwarding it to the full board for the board to recommend that it go to the university for inclusion in the general policies or regulations or whatever that document is called.
So that recommendation, it seems to me, would also have some reporting requirements attached to it. So would we add then to the recommendation that there be some report back to the board of the final determined policy that's been adopted through whatever process is required?
We would do that in the action item to the board. We wouldn't do it in the policy itself. But we can make that part of the, we call it the item for the action item. And we can do that.
Okay. All right, so then there is a motion to prepare for presentation to the full board an item that will delegate the authority of the university to establish and implement an administrative leave policy. Am I saying this right?
Yep. That would be on the terms presented to us with the two modifications that we've discussed.
Yeah, that.
Okay.
Is that a sufficient motion?
Yeah.
I understood it already.
Yeah.
As long as you understand that what we are not doing is proposing to the full board that we adopt a policy at the next meeting, which would is something we could do. It wouldn't even require a first reading. We could do it at the next full board meeting. Then it would be a policy.
Right.
We're opting out of that option. Yeah. We're choosing instead to present to the university this policy and saying, make this a university
policy. Establish a policy consistent with the parameters established here.
Yeah.
So I'll
Who's
make that motion.
Second.
Okay. That motion has been made and seconded. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposition? Okay. Thank you.
Okay, well, we'll have to talk about that. So we, at this point, know that we're not prepared to consider a naming rights policy at today's meeting. So I'm going to move what I think is the only logical motion, which is to table this matter until the next meeting.
Is it postpone or table under Roberts? I think it's postpone.
Postpone the matter.
Yes, I'll second that motion.
Okay, the motion is to postpone the naming rights policy until the next meeting. Is there is that motion's been seconded? Is there any discussion?
I only have an inquiry. Generally, where are we at in preparing this? If anybody knows.
I have had several conversations with the foundation. They are taking the lead on it. They have prepared a outline today on what their current policy is. They've not moved to the next step. I believe that they will be prepared to provide you that next step at the next meeting.
Okay. So I'd only like to register my interest in seeing that it actually happens at the next meeting, because we were going to do it this time and it didn't show up.
They have new counsel and they're working through it.
I think things can happen, but if we don't express an interest in having it done, I can almost guarantee it won't happen. So I'd just like to relay that message.
This is a long-standing matter for the board. We've talked about it several times, and so I appreciate Trustee Strauss's comment. The motion has not been voted on, I don't believe.
Nope.
So all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposition? Seeing none, the naming rights policy action is postponed. I'm very pleased to be at the point of saying that we have with us the Executive Secretary of the University Council and the President of the Faculty Senate. Have I said those things correctly? Greg Long, Professor Greg Long. Even though my name's on here with President Baker, really I believe this is a presentation from both Professor Long and Dr. Baker, which concerns an effort that we've been hopeful will begin at some point. Of course, always our organic documents that we use to govern the university are under review. This isn't to say that there hasn't been a concern for this in the past, but it looks as though we are looking at the possibility of putting forward a new charter, a fresh look at all of the documents, and correcting for any potential conflicts, and moving toward a system that will provide a more nimble process for curricular change and academic innovation. So I'll turn the floor over to our guests. Welcome, and you can tell us a little bit about this activity.
And thank you all for providing this opportunity. I'd also like to thank and acknowledge Therese Clarcarado and George Slotsky, who are my colleagues. Therese is the chair of the combined Faculty Senate University Council Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee that's going to be taking this on as their major charge, and George is the Vice President of the Faculty Senate. So they're kind enough to join me here today and provide a little moral support.
And if I could say, feel free to seek to be acknowledged. I mean, if you want to say something, happy to give you the opportunity.
And I'll start off by providing just a very little background. I know we've got some time limits. NIU, we basically became a university in 1955. 30 years after that, roughly, the administration was very concerned about the idea that we might be subsumed within a regency system. And so created a constitution of bylaws that we currently have that was intentionally designed to be resistant to change. It was very, very detailed, such that, well, many of us would consider working rules as they relate to various governance documents actually got codified as bylaws. And so we have a constitution of bylaws that are significantly different than many other universities. Let me give you an example really quick of when I talk specificity. This is the constitution and bylaws from University of Virginia. This is Kent State, Western Michigan, Miami University, ISU, North Carolina.
We're all so eager to see how many.
Yeah, but, and this is a little exaggerated because these are your board regs. There's 71 pages of board regs and 171 pages of constitutional bylaws. And when I say that this creates a problem, you have no idea. Because what they did, and again, this was unintentional. I talked to Ann Kaplan, and in fact, after the last board meeting, we walked out together and I said, I both tip my hat to you and curse you. Because they did a tremendously good job of what they wanted to do, because they tied this up in knots. Because when you have, you know, 171 pages of bylaws, we have 23 pages devoted to grievance bylaws. Grievance, and they're so specific. I mean, that if we want to change a, you know, the person has 15 days to respond versus 10 days to respond, that's a bylaw change. That's not a policy, that's not working rules, that's a bylaw change as it's currently constructed.
And how many votes would that take to change?
Well, I thank you for bringing that up, President. Yeah, we work really well together. Because that is our major issue with this, too, because you have all these bylaws and all the specificity, and to change bylaw requires two-thirds of the entire membership of university council. Membership of the University Council runs roughly 60, 61, 62, depending upon you know, student representation and appointments. So what that means is that to change any bylaw requires that we roughly have 40, 41 votes to pass something. And that has proven to be a challenge for us. As a very substantive thing, in April, for example, a number of people worked together to create a baccalaureate curriculum council, and it was to increase efficiency, because right now we have six undergraduate curricular bodies that, you know, and having been here for 25 years, I still can't tell you exactly what each one does that's separate from the other. And so in this particular proposal, they put forth a baccalaureate curriculum council. First reading, no problem whatsoever. Second reading, it comes up, and the vote was 38 in favor, 6 opposed, and 1 abstained. So, I mean, logic would really make you think, well, of course, right? It failed, because we needed to have 40 votes. So a vote of 38 to 6 to 1 meant that that didn't pass, and so it put us down back another 12 to 18 months as far as even being able to readdress that. That's silly. The more recent one that is even a bit more stunning is the University Assessment Panel. They
a committee that nobody actually really wants to be on ever.
Right, no one wants to be on it. And there was an update on it in terms of basically changing some titles. You know, so the previous title is this, the new title is this, right? So, I mean, nothing substantive. And this came up for a vote earlier in the semester, and it came back up on the 2nd of this month. The vote on this was 40-0-2. We actually did 42 votes. So we had that fail. So we can't even operate in a fashion, given the specificity and the standard at which bylaws have to be changed. Because the other part of this is our typical attendance is 45 people.
So how many votes does it take to amend?
40. So we start off any vote with 15 no's. And that's, I mean, so when we talk about faculty not being able to get things done, it's true, but I would also, if I can blame administrators 30 years ago, to say, what the heck were you doing when you created this? Because, again, it was made sense 30 years ago, but right now it's killing us. You know, that we can't create a document or we can't change simple rules. You know, 40-0-2 and that doesn't pass. What logical, sane person thinks that's reasonable? You know, so with that being said, we do definitely want to become more efficient and inclusive. We recognize the need to move faster, as you all have said in here. So our first priority is to deal with the voting issue for bylaws. That we're stuck with, this is bylaws, but at least can we lower the standard a bit off the bat? Because most other documents, if you look at, I mean, I've read all of these others, for them, they identify changes to bylaws as being a quorum and the quorum votes. You know, so it's not, they don't set the standard of two-thirds of the entire body. So, I mean, we're kind of out of line with what a number of other institutions do. So it makes it very difficult. So our first task is to go in and we'll have a first reading of this. Teresa's already made some contact, or making some contact with our Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee. Because right now, from a voting standpoint, we're saying, as currently written, to become effective, an amendment to the bylaws must be approved by 2/3 of the current membership of the University Council. So that's the 2/3 I was mentioning about. What we're going to do is we're going to come in and we're going to propose that it requires the presence of a quorum, and a quorum is 50% plus one. And to become effective, an amendment must be approved by a vote of 2/3 of the voting members in attendance. That's very similar to what other universities, other governance places do. So just want to, that's going to be our, at least our initial discussion with Rules, Governance, Elections. That would then come to University Council in our first meeting in, it's actually February the 3rd, and it comes up, would come up for a second reading on March the 7th.
So but you need 40 votes to pass that.
We need 40 votes to pass that. And I've already been shaking the bushes, talking to people, meeting with the Student Association in the spring, as well as sending out individual invitations to all the Student Advisory Committee members. I do not want to go into that meeting with any sense of having fewer than 50 people present and also knowing where any pushback might come from. On a positive statement, thus far, presenting it to University Council and Faculty Senate and other administrators and individuals on campus, I've received no pushback from anyone. That when you say, gosh, look at this, think of the vote requirements, it seems pretty pretty apparent to most people. So that's kind of our first step, as we would see, because I've talked to Trustee Butler, talked to Trustee Marshall to get some of their ideas about this, and both had suggested, as we think of this, it's not only process, but also some kind of a timeline. You know, so how would we go about doing this? And I'm going to be fairly tentative because we have not yet even got the vote thing set through University Council. So I'm suggesting that this is how I anticipate it's likely to play out. And if y'all think differently or whatever, let me know. But I think our first order of business, our top priority, is dealing with the voting on the bylaws. That if we can get that changed, that gives us some opportunity to do other things. Yes.
So I'm sure you've thought about this, the path of maybe trying to jump to the end faster, right, and swallow the whole fish, to some degree, to say, let's all get together and really and skinny the entire thing down, because I realize the vote thing just gets you a path to being a little bit easier in the future, but it does absolutely nothing to the zillion things that are in the bylaws, right, and then you got to chip away at that. Is there any appetite, or is there any stated resistance to just jumping to the end so we can look a lot like the skinnier versions?
I think from at least at this point, initially from a shared governance perspective, I'd like to try to do it through our typical channels, but I also recognize that if the typical channels don't work, then the nuclear option is something to think about.
Yeah. Just for the record, the General Counsel did not use that word.
I'm sorry. I've heard others use it.
It almost seems to me that you might have as much resistance in getting the voting thing changed as you might get the entire thing done.
I don't think the voting change will be so much of an issue because, at the last meeting, it looks embarrassing when you have a vote of 40-0-2 and you're talking about something that is as inconsequential as some basically aligning some names. So I don't think the vote issue is going to be much of a concern. I think what comes next is going to be a concern in terms of even... I'm sorry,
go ahead, Mark. Sure.
I don't want to interfere in the Faculty Senate's business if the Faculty Senate can get its business done as it wishes. My question is, if the Faculty Senate can't get its business done as it wishes, along the lines that Trustee Struthers was inquiring... I would assume that the Board of Trustees still has power to say, we no longer recognize this document, we would like to start over.
It's in your second paragraph of the Board of Trustees' rights.
So, and I think we share an interest in seeing that the institution is governable, and we share an interest from our prior conversations as a board in seeing that inconsistencies within those regulations and between those regulations and other documents that the board weighs in on are resolved in one way or another. So, I, again, if your first choice is to try to solve some number of these challenges yourself, have at. My personal view is, if you get to the point where you say, we're throwing in the towel on doing this ourselves, we need your help, then I'm perfectly willing to have that conversation. I would like for that conversation, if we get to the point where we have it, to be after we've all done an inventory of the catalog of things that we want to have changed so that we don't have to go through this brain surgery one section at a time like we've been doing today. Because
right.
We suffer some of the same impediments.
Absolutely.
We're tinkering on the edges of stuff that's been around forever. We get it, if we have the chance and we can start from scratch, I think that might be easier than doing it one piece at a time. But I'm not in a position where I'm going to dictate to the university council what the university council wants.
Right. And I think at this time, too, we're also, you know, well, I look at this as a, just a just an amalgamation of all sorts of things that we really don't yet know or have a good handle on what the specific inconsistencies are between, say, Board of Trustees regulations, the university constitutional bylaws, and the academic policy and procedure manual. Those are our three main governing documents, if you would, and at this point, we don't yet have a handle on that. In fact, one of the requests I was going to make is if we could get some assistance from the General Counsel's office to help us identify where some of those inconsistencies are. Because if we do go forward with this, as I'm hoping we will, we want to make sure that everything is aligned. Because right now, there's some...
NHR.
NHR,
yes. Like, for example, with graduate assistant positions where... One authority will say there's a cap at X, and another authority will say, no, you can go on with special approval, and there's that. So,
right.
And she's already kind of identified a lot of those things.
Great, yeah, because that, you know, if we do that, that gives us more argument for making the change. Because, again, we don't want to be in a position where, you know, which document you look at determines what action you take. That puts us at risk.
Greg, so before you continue, so... I don't think we have an action item here. I think we have an informational presentation, and
yes.
I think we can let Bob go. But I think we're leaning toward coming up with sort of a set of recommendations that we're going to make about you guys working together and beginning to develop the reforms.
Right.
So I just want to make sure you know where we're headed as you
and
take off.
Agree wholeheartedly on moving forward.
Great. Thanks.
Take care, Bob.
All right, you may continue. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, thanks. So again, from a timing prioritization, dealing with voting, talking, then looking at the alignment or any inconsistencies. Those are kind of our first two things. I think we can get, you know, in theory, both of those could be done by end of March, for example, because we'll certainly know the vote by first part of March. And we also have a graduate assistant starting in January in our office who is a doc student in political science who has a particular interest in policy. So he's very interested in helping, you know, go spend some time going through this work as well. But once we do that, then the third step would be to prioritize bylaws for change. As I mentioned before, the grievance bylaws are absolutely maddening. They're not efficient. They're not helpful. To make changes in them require, you know, I say going from 5 days to 15 days or 5 days to 10 days. Anything even as simple as that is a bylaw change and would argue that we need to pull a lot of the material out that's under the grievance bylaws right now, and many of those could be policies, procedures, but to have them be bylaws really makes it, again, as I look at these other documents, and all of these other documents and all the other constitutional bylaws I've looked at, they may at most have a paragraph. One of these had a paragraph, the others just had a single line that says, you know, faculty rights and student rights will be protected. But they don't put in here bylaws. We have 20-some pages of bylaws of procedures. So look at that. An issue that came up as another potential priority for the BOT would be at your last meeting, talked about temporary appointments and timing on that. That might be something to look at. We're also looking at and recognizing that the faculty SPS advisor position is, it's a bylaw. I mean, again, it's odd to think of something like that there's a position identified as a bylaw. But within that, there's some confusion in terms of That person's at this point not getting a release time and getting paid for doing work, and are they available and so forth. So I want to potentially look at that, and there may be other issues that you identify as potential priorities. I mean, I'm very much looking at this as a collaborative process. If we're going to do this, it has to be something where we know your concerns, you know our concerns. This is a big deal if we're able to do this. And then the fourth step would be to identify the desired governance structure. I mean, are we able to fix what we have now? Do we need to start from scratch? Are there other models that are out there that we might look at and try to emulate? My job up to this point has been, A, to kind of learn my role as Faculty Senate President and Executive Secretary of University Council, and also to learn the Constitution and bylaws, because I made the admission to the other groups, but prior to taking this job, I've never read the Constitution and bylaws. I mean, I've been a faculty member for 25 years here, and the need for me as a general faculty member to read the Constitution and bylaws was never part of my agenda. I looked at certain aspects of it, but big picture, no. And so now that I've looked at it, you know, you realize, wow, you know, we have some issues here, but I don't have a suggestion for how it has to ultimately be structured. I would say two goals that I would have for that would be a real clear delineation of, like, so what's a bylaw versus what's a policy? Because right now it seems to kind of go, well, this is a bylaw, so we'll keep it as a bylaw, versus should this be a policy? There's not a lot of clarity on that. I would also think that we need to maintain some level of university-wide structure for bigger kinds of discussions. But NIU is unique from a faculty senate standpoint in that in all the other governance documents I've looked at, faculty senate is actually has responsibility for curricular decisions. That curricular decisions stop at faculty senate. In our current governance system, the faculty senate is nothing more than a caucus body. We have absolutely no power, no authority, no anything. And so things come up to us, and they go up to university council, where they get voted down 38-6-1. You know, and that's the maddening aspect of this. And so as we move forward looking at this, we'd like to see faculty senate actually be given some of the power that's very typical of other universities. So we're not suggesting anything here that's a power grab or that's making us really different than others. We're saying we already are very, very different than other institutions, and can't we create something that allows our governance structure to work a lot better? You know, I would even argue as we do this, make it readable too. I mean, I'm sorry, but it's legal.
Trustee Strauss.
We already had as phase three of, I think it was phase three of our original work product, that we were going to take a look at how to rationalize all of the organic governing documents that we had. So I think our challenge is at this point, I believe we're up to phase 47. And instead of having three total phases, we've got about 180. But if there's interest on behalf of the University Council and engaging this discussion, maybe we should also spend some time preparing ourselves for the conversation without knowing exactly what at what point we're going to be called on to participate. So we've had a willingness to do this, but it hadn't risen to the top.
Right.
My suggestion is that we get to the point where we're ready to engage in that conversation whenever it's appropriate.
And we will certainly do everything we can to maintain communication. I mean, I'm very committed to this. As corny as it sounds, I'm at a point in my career where, you know, if we can pull this off, this leaves a lasting legacy. This is something that can really make a difference. And I'm able to be in this position for another three semesters. So I'm potentially able to be executive secretary until basically June of 17, and I'm willing to devote the majority of my focus in collaboration with my colleagues to this particular project, because this is the biggest project I think perhaps University Council has attempted in 30 years. But if we can pull this off, we set ourselves up for potentially the next 30 years of being a responsive and efficient organization.
Trustee Struthers.
And this, I don't know if you answered this question directly, but what is the tenor of that, of the 60 members? Are you pretty collaborative now? Is the boat generally going the same, you know, where's the same, or are there lots of different interests that are competing there?
Well, George has an interest in speaking as well. Maybe you could.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe you can address this.
I just want to add to Greg's comments that I also think there's a window of opportunity right now in the next year or so. There's a number of changes that are going on within the university. And my read, I've been VP of the Faculty Senate about 6-7 years. But my read of it is, I think we can get this through, and people would be in favor of this change. We tried this 5 years ago, I don't think we could have done it. I would hate to wait another 3 years. I think there is a window of opportunity.
And then responding to your question, there is a difference, but it's a difference I suspect we find in most universities, in that when you get the faculty senate together, that's just faculty. And so we can sometimes be vocal and lumpy, sometimes, if you would, if that's a nice way of putting it.
Sure.
Whereas I think university council, given the diversity of the group, you tend to have a bit more restrained discussion on topics. People aren't quite as off the handle sometimes as we may see in the other meeting. But the university council is where the vote occurs, and so that's our concern. So the faculty senate can say and do whatever they want, but when it comes right down to it, it's all what happens in university council. And we're working on the student involvement too, because at this point, out of roughly 60 people, students make up 16 out of those 60 seats, and their average attendance is about 8 or 9. And so we lose half of the student votes as no's at this point in any bylaw change we have.
Have you considered serving food?
Well, you might want to talk to our budget people, because we actually serve. we still have cookies. We still have cookies.
All right. Are there other comments or questions? Because I want to sort of sum up what I think I'm hearing. So you're reporting to us that there's an interest in inventorying the university's organic governance documents for efficiencies and innovation, and for a new charter that will permit us to move forward in the spirit of shared governance. You're going to begin by seeking to amend the bylaws, to be able to amend the bylaws with fewer votes. And that's a first step in opening the door to these changes. Then you're going to inventory the documents for conflicts, inefficiencies compared to other potential frameworks and structures. Then you're going to three prioritize policies for reform, or areas for reform. It seems to me that's where we're probably going to enter at stage two as soon as you get this vote. And then we're going to try to together propose a structure, then create the associated documents, which may require some work of this committee as well. So there's sort of five steps I see. I'm delighted that you're interested in doing this. I think the whole board will be as well. I think what we need to do is express our desire for the Office of the General Counsel to work with you in identifying the documents and the areas where reform would be useful, and to begin to think about how to structure the proposed new structure.
Yeah, that's right.
Do I have there's no vote here, but is that a sufficient step for us at this stage?
That plan works for me. I'd only say that if you get to the point where you want to blow it all up and start over again and come back and talk to us, because I'm happy to entertain that option too.
Okay.
I'm happy to propose it tomorrow if you wish.
I'll be...
Well, you know, if I weren't worried about the initial response to it, I have an inclination to think that would be good. I mean, they really did a good job 30 years ago tying this up in a knot. I mean, they intentionally set out to create a document that was resistant to change, that, you know, that was to protect ourselves. And so untying that knot, you know, like I say, I'm easily able to recognize the issue, but I don't know necessarily the best strategy for dealing with it. I just know that if we don't change the voting issues right off the bat, then we are truly stuck. And if For example, if we could not get the vote issue changed, that may be where we come back to you and say, hey, help us out. I would rather us do that internally, because I think we want to have ownership of this. So, I mean, so it's not meant at all to be us versus you, or that we don't want to collaborate, but if we can work this out through our own governance structure, that would also help to empower us, because the faculty already feel a bit disempowered as far as the structure goes.
Trustee Shivers.
Okay, this is for clarity for me. When you said that you kind of wanted to revamp the governance structure, is that what you mean?
I'm sorry.
But you said you wanted to, like, I don't know how you worded it, but it was like you wanted to revamp.
It could potentially mean.
I mean,
no constitution.
Okay. It could be like a constitutional convention. You know, that's no, and not that that's something we're wanting.
Because you said how basically our faculty senate doesn't really have much, like, there's no teeth.
No,
course.
There's no teeth.
Okay, so, like, I think that's where I want to know more information when you get to that point. Like, who's going to be doing what? Because, I mean, I haven't read that thing either. But I think maybe I will have to see what, and I can see what parts.
Oh, sure.
Like,
oh, yeah.
I don't think what I'm getting at is, like, the student component of shared governance. I don't want that to diminish.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
I
appreciate that. And in terms of how I work with any group, I'm very, very inclusive.
Yeah,
and we already have good solid relationships with Student Association, SPS, operating staff, because we do need to have some, you know, however it's organized, we need to have some mechanism where all the relevant constituencies have the opportunity to participate.
Sure.
But we also need to have some mechanism where it's not so darn hard to make changes. I mean, for us, it takes 12 to 18 months to get a new course proposed. University of Cincinnati, they've got it down where you can do it in a month, you know, because of how their governance works and curricular processes work and bylaws. And so there are ways that we could become much more efficient at how we do things that our current governance documents inhibit us from doing.
Yeah.
It's also being respectful of our human resources.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a good use of faculty or staff time to have a structure this inefficient. That's not meaningful, sure.
No, it makes it a lot.
Yep. Okay, I think we've expressed our interest in this activity. Thank you very much for coming before us. Thank you for joining us this evening. I hope that the entire meeting wasn't too boring. Thank you. For the record, nuclear option is not a term that is used by anyone on this committee or the administration.
I just read another situation. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make that up, but I apologize.
No, it's totally
constitutional
fine.
Convention.
I actually edit very heavily the minutes of these meetings and will eliminate it. So,
you too.
Thank you.
Thank you. In terms of next steps, I'll talk to the committee members and the general counsel's office and the president about where we're moving next. Obviously, naming rights is still a very important subject for us. There's some reporting and meeting that needs to take place with regard to the exemptions that we talked about earlier and the issue of the board provisions for when we vote on items, which will take place. What I think we'll do now is just simply ask if there's other matters to come before the committee.
Can I make a motion to adjourn?
You may make a motion to adjourn.
Then I will.
All right. There's a motion to adjourn. Is there a second?
Second.
Can we vote? Can we adjourn? Can we close this meeting?
Aye.
I don't think we can. This meeting has to stay open. Forever.
Until careful what you say for the next month.
All right. Thank you very much. It's opinion of the chair that the meeting is adjourned.